Well, this morning, an insider story of China's Communist Party elite and one family's personal cost after falling out of favour. Hong Kong-raised businessman Desmond Shum's book, Red Roulette, is a no-holds-barred account of the life he lived as a wealthy businessman, entrepreneur and philanthropist in China in the 1990s and early 2000s. He writes about how the party works and its connection with wealthy individuals, corruption, vengeance, and how the Chinese business system works. Also, the dramatic changes since the early 2000s. Desmond Shum's story is all the more intriguing following the mystery disappearance and recent reappearance of his former wife, Whitney Duan. She was the mastermind of multi-million dollar real estate projects when she disappeared 4 years ago, resurfacing earlier this month to phone her former husband to ask him not to publish Red Roulette. Desmond Shum is with us from his home in the United Kingdom. Desmond, welcome to 9 to Noon and thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So how much of a shock this month and your reaction to hear from your former wife after 4 years and no contact?
It's a great surprise. I was pleasantly surprised how efficient the bureaucrat in Beijing was in this case.
Can you elaborate?
Well, Wall Street Journal and Financial Times published the story of her disappearance and my upcoming book on Friday. And then she has disappeared for 4 years. Not a single person has heard from her. On Sunday, we get to talk to each other.
What did you say to each other?
We first get her on the phone with our son, who's 12 now, who hasn't talked to his mom since he was 8. So they got some catch up. She was asking, how tall are you now? What's your weight? How are you doing in school? And then afterwards, she asked to speak to me separately. And she asked me to stop the publishing of the book.
What was happening? Your reference to the Beijing bureaucrat is a reference to what?
I was publishing my memoir of what I, you know, it is, I'm 53 now. It's my life, you know, my life sort of, I went to doing business in China 30 years ago. So our rise mirrored the rise of China. So I was writing down and publishing what I see, what I saw, what I experienced, what I did. And what I was thinking at the time, I guess that was forbidden.
So the call coming at this time is not coincidental. What do you believe was behind your wife not phoning you for 4 years and phoning you now? What has happened to her?
She got disappeared. I selected the publishing day on the 4th year's anniversary of her disappearance. Nobody have heard from her, including her parents, whom I have kept in touch with over the years, just to keep checking on, you know, how she's, if she ever appear. So her sudden reappearance, it's a present surprise to all our family. And but her message is, it's a warning shot to me.
Was she under duress, do you believe?
For sure. She started a conversation telling me she signed a paper of temporary release and she said they can snatch back her back anytime.
What do you know of what happened to her over those 4 years, either from her or from what you know has happened to others?
I assume her phone is being listening, if not somebody is sitting right across from her. So she cannot disclose, because one of the first thing I asked her is, you know, you have been taken for 4 years. What's the charge? She said that's confidential and she cannot disclose that. And obviously she cannot disclose what her experience was in the 4 years. But she did say she have no news of the outside world in the last 4 years. Her mom actually passed away back in June. She just learned about it. And, you know, obviously, it doesn't seem like, you know, the pandemic has been going on for 2 years now.
Have you been able to establish somehow from her? Has she acknowledged somehow that the reason she disappeared was for at least part of that time she was held by authorities, held by Chinese government authorities?
Yes, because when the time she was taken, that's three other colleagues of her were taken also. And those three reappear sometime early last year. So after 3 years of disappearance, they reappear without a charge. And then she was barred from leaving China 6 months before her disappearance. So there is no doubt she was taken by the government, although the government never acknowledged taking her.
However, does it appear that she had been released prior to this call? Was that what she was suggesting to you?
No, she was never released. Okay. She just came out.
She pleaded with you not to publish the book. What were your thought processes in going ahead and publishing it?
I think the first thing is she called me. We talked on Sunday, and the book was coming out last Tuesday. So, you know, my view was like, my thought was like, some stupid bureaucrat in Beijing must be thinking, you know, this is going to be like China. You decided to pop, you know, snap up a finger, the books are going to disappear off the bookshelf across China. But reality is, on you call me on Sunday, the book will be coming out on a Tuesday. The books are already in the bookstore or on the way to the bookstore. It's nothing I can do, even if I decide not to publish it. It's out of my hand. Not that I would like, you know, I would comply with that.
So what are your fears for her now that this has happened? As you said, you couldn't stop it. Where are you left now? And you know, your son, where, and her family, where are you all left now?
We have left Beijing for UK 5-6 years ago. So our son and I are now living in the United Kingdom.
But you're left now not knowing what's going to happen to Whitney. Can we...
I think...
Go ahead, please.
Well, I think anything is, you know, anything... The first four, I mean, without that book coming out, without this news, she wouldn't reappear. So, and then my son wouldn't get to talk to her. So for all of us, that's a big step forward. And actually, it seems like she remained now because yesterday, my son called her phone number and she answered. So she, you know, for now, she's at least she's still out and she's reachable.
Can we talk about your life together? And you mentioned at the start that it mirrored the times in China. The book goes into your own childhood, which had its own challenges. You were not wealthy, your family. You write very openly about your father's, we would call it abuse in this country, of you. It could might otherwise be construed as very strict discipline, physical discipline. And you have this ambition, you go to the States, you study, you become a business person. Could you bring us forward to when you are beginning to do business in China and Hong Kong also, but primarily in China, and you meet Whitney? Because this is where we get this entree into a time and a place in China. Could you tell us a little of it, please?
Yes. We met at the beginning of the 2000s through a business deal. By that time, already been doing business for about 10 years, a decade in China. She bought me, I have to say, she introduced me to this world of communist elites and real political power in China. And then it is something, although I have been doing business in China for a decade, it's something, it was shocking and surprising. It's just like, wow, is that really how China works?
Particularly significant was her friendship with a woman, Auntie Zhang, who befriended her. Well, and whose husband was Wen Xiaobo, who many of us will remember, of course, as a premier, and a premier again at a very significant time in China's modern history and economic history and engagement with the world. What did you learn, not just from that relationship and friendship between your wife and the Premier's wife, but more widely about how business was done and how business and authority and government and the party interacted?
I think, you know, in my early days doing business in China, we all know that you need guanxi with party officials. But until I get introduced to Auntie Zhang and then working with them, actually became business partners with them and seeing, you know, working with them and together with them, with ministers, with director generals, with, you know, the top epsilon of state-owned enterprise. It's the first time I think I really get to learn, oh, wow, that's how the machine really works in China.
And how would you describe that?
I think it's completely, it depends on personal relationship. And that personal relationship is built upon courtship, interests. And it's a very intricate thing because it's, and then profit, you know, profit sharing. So it's a very intricate thing. It's very complicated. You know, you're mixing in profit with personal relationship. There's no clear rule in how you operate, and the rule as like develops as you go along. Especially for me, because I don't know the rules of game. You know, with that crowd, and until sometime into it,
President Xi Jinping has led a significant change in approach from the China of the time that you were working there, and one of the things he has led is a crackdown on corruption. Was there corruption to be cracked down on?
I think yes and no. I mean, I do think corruption, I mean, corruption is rampant, I mean, even to today. So it's you know, we have to used to it. Like 30 years ago when I first went to China, we used to have this joke by party standard, you line up all the Communist Party member against the wall, you shoot them one after another, you're shooting too few of them, you shoot every one of them, you are probably mistaking a few innocent ones. But by today's standard, you know, you shoot every party member, you're probably not going to mistake anyone. So that's why the population welcomes this quote unquote anti-corruption drive. But reality is this, I think two things we have to remember and not to mistaken. The number one thing is, who is the real benefit and real master of corruption? Is this red aristocrat, which is what I call them. They are like the medieval aristocrat, you know, descendant by bloodline, the early founders of the Communist Party, the generals of early days of the Communist Party, or China's establishment. That's one thing. The other thing is, as I demonstrate in a book with antidotes, this anti-corruption drive is more about taking out political rivals than anti-corruption.
When did things begin to change? Because China's market economy within a communist government structure was booming. We know it opened up to the world more. We saw the emergence of a Chinese middle class. We saw it become part of the World Trade Organization with New Zealand's support, actually. And then we have seen what appears to be now a rapidly increasing change in approach from the incumbent president. But when did you first see change? We should mention the Beijing Airport Logistics Hub was one of your biggest deals, right? And I think you noted in retrospect around 2007 that the director or the airport manager, quote, disappeared. In retrospect, was that the beginning of what was to become a series of disappearances?
I think disappearances in China system it's a rather commonplace, but it just disappearing for 4 years is rather uncommon. In terms of, I think what has happened is, I think what I see and reflecting what I experience, Xi Jinping is a symptom of the systematic issue of the Communist Party of China. He is a symptom. He is not a cause. The opening, Deng Xiaoping has this quote unquote reform opening in 78, not because he wanted to reform an opening. It's because this party state is completely bankrupt. The only choice they have is to let the farmer choose what crop to grow and to let the private entrepreneurs and open up some business and revive the economy. And anytime when the system fails and the party state fails, they are powerful enough, they push back against the private enterprise and push back against the international company in the domestic market. That is just the, so it's the system encroaching back.
So what's happening at the moment with some of what we're seeing, the tech guru Jack Ma is the highest profile, the Alibaba founder, and we saw the rise and rise and rise of that company, one of the biggest and wealthiest companies in the world, most influential in the world. What is happening with the Jack Ma's and others right now? When they sort of disappear from our sight and we don't hear from them, what's happening?
I think in the early days, what happened, you know, with the Chinese economy, you look at the richest people in China economy, the industry that comes up always has been in the industries that the state-owned enterprise don't know how to work or don't think it's worthwhile to do it. So the early days of China is the line manufacturing, right? Exporting the goods. And they don't know how to, you know, make product for international market. Once they understand it, they come in to take over it. And then was the real estate industry, because, you know, in the past, everybody got a house distributed. They don't think building houses to sell is anything worthwhile doing. And that's where the real estate industry booming, and then we make money. And then the taxi industry becomes the billionaire maker. And then that's because the state enterprise doesn't know how to do it. But once they figured out, oh, it's powerful enough, and they start to crawl back into it. In particular, the case of Jack Ma, I mean, the tech industry, I think what happened was the presidential election of the US presidential election, the censorship demonstrated by the tech companies really scared the CCP. They first time look at it as like, wow, is that what you can do with a tech platform? And obviously, Jack Ma, being an outspoken person as he is, which is rather unusual in the China system, just called the bad break. The first one called the bad break. But it's not just him, just as the first in the line. It's the entire system they want to rim back in.
So now we see the billionaires handing over their billions because of the shared prosperity philosophy of President Xi. Effectively, you're saying that President Xi is taking the country back to the party's fundamentals, if you like, rather than this quasi-capitalist or market system under a one-party government. In some ways, what you're describing is the incumbent president returning to the fundamentals, I guess.
Depends on how you define the fundamentals. I think, the CCP's fundamental is really the most important tenet of their fundamentals, as one may call it, is permanent hold on power. That's the fundamental rule number one of the game for Xi Jinping and his and people like him, the Red Elsewhere, is permanent hold on political power.
So you don't see it as some kind of ideological purity; you see it as purely about power.
I think there is number one thing is he is there to revive, in his view, revive the hold on power by the CCP. I do think in his pursuit of that, he does see this socialist element of his early education does come into play. But that is not the cause. The cause is the hold on power.
Let's talk about Hong Kong too, where you grew up and where you make some big confessions in this book, because we the other big move we have seen under President Xi has been the crackdown, to be blunt, in Hong Kong, and the move very much to bring it, to claim it in its fullest, in the fullest way for the mainland. You confess in this book that you and others were part of the counter-revolution, if you like, around the time of the Umbrella Revolution, that you were part of facilitating, I'm quoting you here, China's direct meddling in Hong Kong elections. What amazes me is that none of us ever came out publicly and said, this is what I did and it was wrong. What did you do and why?
I think, well, I joined the CPPCC for about a decade, and since the mid, about 2005, I think. What happened was we were asked to help them meddle in the local elections. And we all...
Asked by whom?
We have this called United Front. And then different ministry under the United Front. So we were, there's a Hong Kong Macau office.
So asked by the Chinese Communist Party, effectively.
Yes.
And so what did you do?
We were asked to, you know, pay for people to, you know, get our employee to vote for certain candidates. We were asked to campaign, paying for different campaigns to vote for certain candidates. And then we need to report back how many people we motivate to vote for the candidate they have suggested.
And now that you say, I did this and it was wrong.
No, actually, I didn't say that. That's what they asked me to do. Reality is I've never done all of that, although I report back to say, I did this and I did that, because I never believe in this thing. I was like, you know, what crap is that? So I actually, you know, I was asked and I did report to them and write a report, say, oh, I did, you know, 500 people to vote for this guy. But I actually, in reality, I never did that. The first time I ever voted was late 2019, where, you know, we have this local council election, the Democrats win by a landslide. That was the first time I ever voted in my life in Hong Kong.
What is it that you want people to understand the most from the book?
I think there's a lot of mystery, a lot of hot air around what CCP really is, how China really work. I just want to show people, this is what I experienced, this is how things work.
It coincides, Yes.
Yeah, I think just it has never happened in recent history. A business person in my situation, a top echelon of business world, have intimate interactions with the political top echelon of political leaders of China, actually come out to tell the story.
This happens at a time where there's been long-standing concern by some economists about the level of China's debt. We are focused very much at the moment, or economists are, on what's happening in its property sector. We see just today one of its biggest real estate developers struggling to avoid defaulting on billions of dollars of debt. Debts continue to rise despite the government's stated aim to reduce exposure to debt. With this enormous shift that's now happening again economically as well as socially, what do you foresee for China's economy?
I think that the economy would be very difficult. Reality is my own experience. Almost last 10 years of growth in China is debt, is relying on growth of debt. So some of that is, and that's both to the state sector and to the private company, and that is unraveling. So I think the next few years, I mean, for the coming, I think that the Chinese economy will be very difficult.
What are the implications of that? Are the state-owned companies large enough? The state's involvement in the domestic economy anyway large enough to ride it through, or are there wider implications?
I think it will be, they have been trying that to ride it through. Basically, with every downturn, they try, they issue more debt, and then use the state-owned enterprise to do mega projects and more infrastructures to ride through the downturns. I think this come, it's just has been going on for a decade now. I think that's coming to the end, or it's, I think it's coming to the point of unsustainability.
Desmond, thank you again for your time. Desmond Shum, who is the author of the book Red Roulette, a senior businessman in China, he was, and his wife, as we said, with whom he worked for many years, now his ex-wife, with whom he worked for many years, had disappeared. Her family and he had not heard from her for 4 years until right upon the eve of the publication of the book, where she rang him asking him not to publish it. Red Roulette is the name of the book.